Morning, folks. I'd like to bring the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Representative Purcell, would you be willing? You've been here for a while. Move the minutes of February 24th.
Yes. Mr. Chair, move the minutes.
Thank you. Discussion to the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Welcome, Representative Moline. We'll continue your hearing. We'll be laying your bill over for inclusion in our omnibus bill. Well, I guess I'm supposed to say possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Moline, if you want to begin. And then MPCA, you're planning on staying there while they're there? We'll bring both of the later. Do you have some presentation before they come down, Representative Moline?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for having me back this morning. And we can proceed however you choose to, Mr. Chair. If you want to start out with the PCA and go to questions, that's fine.
Yeah, I think that's where we were at, and we had folks with questions. I don't know if Commissioner Flood or Director Lodhammer have anything specific to add since you were here last time. Otherwise, if you want to give your introductions, who you are, and then members, I'll have to start a new list, so raise your hands if you have questions. Welcome, lady.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Flood. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
And I'm Shannon Lodhammer. I'm the Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division at the PCA.
Okay, thank you. Welcome back. Members, any questions for the testifiers? I guess we're done. No, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question is for Ms. Floodwood. My question on this is basically, as I'm understanding this bill, is that fundamentally it's delaying application of the rule while it's being reviewed. And I'm curious, is there precedent for this? Is this commonly done?
Excuse me, Commissioner, I would like to lay out a roadmap and apologize. I meant to do it. I think we should be able to wrap this discussion up by 9 o'clock. Then we're going to have a relatively quick hearing. Representative Paul Anderson has a bill that I think will only last a few minutes. And then we're going to hear both a bill from Representative Nornes and a bill from Representative Hackbarth. Both of them should be around half an hour for Representative Nornes and maybe a little less for Representative Hackbarth's bill. So just kind of laying out a roadmap, Commissioner. So we're hoping to wrap up our discussion here, members, by 9 o'clock. Excuse me. Go ahead,
Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, if I'm understanding your question correctly, Representative Clark Johnson, I just wanted to say that what we're concerned about with this bill is that it would prevent us from addressing issues about wild rice in permits. And it's our concern and contention that by preventing us from addressing the protection of wild rice in permits, that would result in EPA taking action and essentially stepping in where for the state and proceeding with requiring us either to address it or to take over permitting themselves. I think that's our primary concern. This isn't a provision in the Clean Water Act to allow suspension. There's no provision within the Clean Water Act to allow suspension of an existing water quality standard while we're in the process of developing a new one. So that their expectation, EPA's expectation, and the Clean Water Act requires us to deal with the current requirements. And I think if this bill is passed, it really removes any flexibility we might have in addressing wild rice and permitting.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be more clear. What I'm trying to find out is, have we been in, assuming this bill were to pass, have we had a situation similar to this in Minnesota in the past? Would we repeat, or would this be setting kind of a precedent or a new approach for Minnesota?
And Commissioner Flood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so when you say this happening, you're talking about suspending rules. Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, not that I'm aware of. This would be a precedent, as I understand.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, to that point, I mean, I would argue that the agency is setting a precedent by enforcing a rule before the rulemaking is completed. What we have here is a situation where they're enforcing a 10 standard before they've designated and identified which waters the 10 standard would apply to. I'm not aware of them implementing other rules in that fashion, where they set forward a supposed water quality standard without identifying the waters. And so that in and of itself makes this a unique situation where a standard is being imposed before the rulemaking is complete.
Thank you. Representative Hansen to that point.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, I think we heard yesterday that there's a standard that exists right now. So what you just said isn't true. I mean, there's a standard right now that the agency is bound to enforce under the Clean Water Act.
Representative Moline.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, there's a standard, but the waters aren't identified. I would argue that the agency was supposed to identify which waters the standard applies to before imposing a standard. What they do right now is on a case-by-case basis, where they, as they've explained to me, basically get into a room together and decide whether or not it's a wild rice water. I would argue that part of the rulemaking process requires them to identify which waters are required to follow that standard.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Moline, but we don't get, it's not a cafeteria with federal law. We don't get to pick and choose what we're going to follow. We have a requirement that's been there, as has been mentioned many times since the 70s. So when there's a permit coming forward, I think the agency, isn't the agency obligated to apply something that's been there and required since the 70s? Now, we may not like it that's been there since the 70s because it's old, but it still exists.
Representative Hansen, that's a good point, but the reality is the agency hasn't been doing that. We're aware of one industrial incident where they said we're going to follow the 10, and they had an opportunity to hold that particular industrial user hostage in some new developments they had at their facility, so they made them and they imposed the 10. Otherwise, universally, it's been on the shelf in a book, not dusted off for a number of years, and that's the predicament we're in today. And so it's what came first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, that's where we're at, and that's why we're having this discussion. So thank you. And I've got Representative Fabian to this point, and then Representative Purcell to this point. Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was just going to point out exactly what you did. I mean, this has been around for 40 years, and now all of a sudden we're afraid of MPC or EPA, and we've never been afraid of them before, and we're going to enforce a standard now, seemingly somewhat haphazardly, and I don't think that MPC has really done a good job of doing the science and stuff to start this. Thank you.
Representative Purcell is to this point. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd take up a little bit of what I said yesterday, but first I want to say, and to your comment about what came first, and what came first was the rice. And the rice creates ecosystems in Minnesota that support fishing and waterfowl and many, many other parts of what we include in a $14 billion industry in Minnesota called tourism. And that's not to say anything about the rice itself and how many millions of dollars that produces for those who harvest, including myself and many others. And to suspend a standard that can impact and degrade wild rice, it doesn't make sense to me that we would suspend that. If we need to identify wild rice waters, let's do that. But why suspend the standard? There's no need to suspend the standard. And has the standard been enforced diligently? I don't know. Do we still have rice? Yes. So that kind of speaks that something's been enforced in the past. Do we have wild rice beds that have been degraded? Yes, by various things. Water level, egg farm, chicken farms have been put too much manure in a wild rice ecosystem. We had to restore all that. And there's a number of situations that I've been involved with. But suspending a standard that may impact the quality and quantity of wild rice in Minnesota, doesn't make any sense to me. If we need to identify waters, let's get PCA to do that. And it was said yesterday that tribes had been contacted or consulted. Somebody said that, and then somebody else said, this was in testimony, I didn't write this all down, Mr. Chair, but I've since spoken with a number of tribal elected leaders. They aren't aware of this suspension of the standard. And the look on their face when I told them that wasn't a pleasant look. So somebody's putting something over here if they're saying they talked to tribal leaders. Not in my district. I got most rice of anybody in Minnesota in my district. So not sure what's going on with all that. But, you know, let's keep it straight and above board. If you're talking to people, let's make sure that that's done. But I don't see suspending the standard, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a bit of a follow-up to Representative Johnson's question to Ms. Plutt. You had mentioned that this was going to affect permitting. Moving forward. And so would the net effect of delaying the rulemaking and having that apply to permitting actually serve to delay the PolyMet permit process if this bill were to go through?
We've heard testimony, Representative Moline, you mentioned that the impact for PolyMet would be quite limited. Do you want to comment on that, Commissioner Flood?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is actually correct, Representative Hornstein, that where our concern is that any new or expanded or modified facility, we would not be able to issue a permit if the permit did not in some way address wild rice protection for discharges that are upstream of wild rice waters.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to address some of these issues. First, to Representative Purcell. I assure you no one that I know of at this table has any intention of harming wild rice. It is a tremendous asset not only to the Native American community but to the entire state of Minnesota. It is, after all, our state grain, and protecting those wild rice beds should be a priority. But I have a series of questions about, how did we get here? How did we get to this point? Director Flood, can you tell me just exactly how we got to the point where this standard kind of came off the shelf? Did you have direct communications from PCA, or did you do some research to indicate to the agency that this standard that has not been vigorously enforced needed to be vigorously enforced at this time?
Commissioner Flood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we began conversations with U.S. Steel about addressing wild rice in their effluent discharge permit and their basin permit beginning in 2001. So we've had conversations with them since that time. In addition, in 2008, there was a legislative appropriation to the Department of Natural Resources to do an assessment of wild rice and where it was in the state and where it wasn't, where it was historically, those types of things. So they provided us that kind of elevated the issue in terms of where wild rice was and where it was in decline, and that continued to then raise questions through permitting and those types of efforts. In addition, several comments were provided to EPA and comments that also came to us regarding wild rice and its presence and raising questions about the fact that we did have a standard on the books for sulfate and the protection of wild rice, and we are obligated to respond to all of the comments, and that again raised the issue in terms of protecting wild rice and those uses for looking at effluent discharge permits. And do you want to add anything to that?
Follow up, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you do have communications from EPA regarding the sulfate standard in wild rice, and when did you receive those?
Commissioner Flood. Director Lothammer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, we would need to go back and look at individual permit applications and draft permits and environmental review efforts to see when specific comments came from EPA. We do have communication from EPA from some of the discussions that happened at the legislature back in 2011 regarding the presence of the standard and the fact that it's federally approved, and EPA's expectation that states address federally approved standards in permits if they have the MPDES program, and then also reinforcing EPA's authority if a state doesn't address a federally approved standard in a particular permit where it would be applicable.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm most curious about this period of time from when the standard was enacted until when we did all of a sudden decided to start bringing it into the conversation. And why wasn't it part of the conversation during that 40-year period is kind of befuddles me, honestly.
Assistant Commissioner Flood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, part of that was that we didn't have a lot of information about and documentation about the presence of wild rice, sulfate concentrations in water, sulfate concentrations in discharges, whether they were mines or other facilities around the state.
Commissioner Flood, I just want to remind you what you just said. There was a law in the books approved by EPA, and you weren't enforcing it for 40 years because, did you say you didn't have enough information about it? I think we need to get real here. Somebody in MPCA found this on the books in a certain year and said, you know what? We've got an opportunity here, and we need to start enforcing this. I think I'm trying to understand this, but it's... No, you don't have the authority to decide for 40 years not to enforce something because you might need more information. I would say sometime between 46 and 90-whatever, somebody should have came to this body and said, hey, you need to spend some money to do a study. We don't know if we've got something real on the books or not. So sorry to be blunt. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So has the EPA threatened to take permits away from you because you haven't been enforcing the standard? And if they have, when did they do that?
Commissioner Flood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they actually have exercised or attempted to exercise their authority to remove our NPDES permitting authority. I have actually an example from my own personal experience when I was employed at the Metropolitan Council and worked as their environmental compliance manager and was responsible for negotiating wastewater permits for all of the council's wastewater treatment plants. EPA came in 1990 when there was a conversation between the council and the Pollution Control Agency about requirements to address phosphorus and threatened to remove the MPCA's authority for permit issuance and actually initiated those proceedings. There's also some more recent examples that we can give, which is about the variance that was granted to Mesabi Nugget and their subsequent disapproval of that variance, as well as their disapproval of our state implementation plan for air emissions, which Director Lothammer can give you more detail about that if you're interested.
Commissioner Flood, can I add, can you tell me how many states have a standard for this material?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's my understanding that Minnesota is the only state that has a sulfate standard for the protection of wild rice. There is another tribal entity that I'm aware of. I believe Fond du Lac has a wild rice, a sulfate standard for the protection of wild rice, as well as the Bad River Band in Wisconsin. They have the authority delegated from U.S. EPA to develop water quality standards on their
so
tribal lands.
In Wisconsin, other than, I don't know if Fond du Lac, I'm assuming Fond du Lac may also be in Wisconsin, but for sure the second tribe, okay, it's not. The second tribe you noted was in Wisconsin. So EPA has no wild rice standard to enforce in Wisconsin at all. We have this one in Minnesota, but in Wisconsin, if they had taconite mines there, if they did, they would be free roaming. There's no EPA requirement. So EPA is required to enforce the standard we developed in the 40s, didn't enforce for decades, and no other state in the nation has this standard. Is that the predicament we're in today?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct, and I would add to that that it's the states that are delegated the NPDES permitting program are also then responsible for developing standards that protect their particular water resources. To my knowledge, there aren't a lot of states that have currently have wild rice in them. It's a unique Minnesota resource currently, and that's why we have a standard for its protection.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, you talked about EPA coming back and working to enforce standards and threaten to deny permits, but did any of those actions have anything to do with sulfate?
Commissioner Flood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, they did not.
Follow-up, Representative Torkelson.
Excuse me. Corrected.
Commissioner Flood.
Sorry, I earlier referenced the Mesabi Nugget NPDES permit, and the issuance of the variance was related to sulfate and other parameters. And Director Lotthammer has an addition.
Director.
Mr. Chair and members, I would like to add that up to this point, we haven't had anything preventing us from applying and working through the application of the existing sulfate standard. So EPA hasn't had a reason to actually come in and disapprove permits. Our concern is that if legislation was passed that prevented us from addressing sulfate and wild rice protection, that's when EPA would then come in, because we would have that prevention in place. And they have been on record saying that is an authority that they have.
Ms. Lothammer, you talked about the protection of wild rice. You have a lot of authority to protect wild rice separate of the sulfate standard, though. Is this not only dealing with the sulfate standard? Don't you have other mechanisms before you if you see a need to protect? I want to make sure we're only talking about this standard, not about the protection of wild rice.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that's correct. This conversation is specific to this standard.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Director Flood. I'm concerned about the time here. You know, we've been working at this for 4 years. You told us yesterday that it will take another 2 to 3 years to complete these studies. What is the agency's plan as far as enforcing the 10 milligram standard in the meantime, and what has been the agency's approach during these last 4 years?
Director Lothammer.
Mr. Chair and members, the agency has been on a case-by-case basis working through applying the existing sulfate standard and addressing sulfate and wild rice. That would be our intent going forward while we were going through the rulemaking process, which is what would take the 2 years. We would look to exercise the flexibility that we have available under the Clean Water Act to address concerns both about applying the standard, but then also about concerns about costs or technology or time that's needed to move forward. So we do have some flexibility that we can exercise. One of the things that we don't have the flexibility to do without EPA coming in is not addressing sulfate and wild rice in some way.
Follow up, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Lothammer, for that answer. So it seems like this kind of comes down to the fear of EPA. But let's focus a little bit on the agency's position on this issue. Do you feel that the sulfate standard should be applied statewide?
Ms. Lothammer.
Mr. Chair and members, based on our analysis to date, which we're still doing, of the wild rice sulfate study information, we do feel that there is an effect that sulfate has on wild rice. It's the mechanism of the effect is that elevated sulfate can increase the sulfide in the sediment, as you've heard from other testifiers, and it's that sulfide that has the effect on wild rice. So we do believe that we need to address sulfate and wild rice concerns. We are working through the science as to do we need to refine the existing standard in order to be more precise in how we do that. That's part of the proposal that we're working on that we hope to or that we intend to have ready as soon as the end of March, is any refinements to the standard to apply the most up-to-date science and address the things that we're learning through the study.
Follow-up, President Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, from that answer, I get the impression that sulfate directly is not the issue, and so this standard seems to be in question.
Director Lothammer.
Mr. Chair and members, Sulfate is the pollutant that raises the sulfide concentration in the sediment. So sulfate is an issue because of that mechanism. There are other factors that can either enhance or inhibit that reaction. Those are some of the things that we're looking at. Those may be more site-specific depending on the particular situation, so we need to better understand that. That's what we're doing right now as we look at, is there a scientific basis to make any changes to the existing standard?
Representative Torkelson, last follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I appreciate your patience. So does the commissioner support applying the 10-milligram standard to the waters of Minnesota?
Commissioner Flood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the commissioner is charged with the implementation of the Clean Water Act under our delegated authority. So while I can't always speak for the commissioner, I would say he's cognizant of his responsibilities under the Clean Water Act.
Representative Halsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe not all members were aware, but it almost sounds as though people aren't aware of everything that's been happening since 2011. In our packet yesterday, we in fact had both the letter from Senator Bach and Representative Dill and the EPA's response. Senator Bach at the time submitted their bills to the EPA to ask for their view of the two draft bills. One of the questions I'll have of the author is whether she has done that with this bill before us. And there's been a lot of conversation around the table is somehow that we're fearful of the EPA. I don't know that it's fearful of the EPA, but we certainly understand their role. And in that response, they are very clear. As you know, House File 1010 and Senate File 1029 propose to modify or suspend the current federally approved water quality standard for wild rice waters of 10. And they go on to some extent, and then to the extent any legislation changes it, you'd have to submit that to the EPA. So I mean, the letter is very clear. It was in your packets yesterday. My first question to the author is, have you done that with this bill? Has this been submitted to the EPA for their review?
Representative Ling.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, I have not submitted this bill to the EPA, but I would say that requesting to go through the rulemaking process on what is a wild rice water before imposing a standard is completely reasonable under the Clean Water Act. I was looking for the 1973 language of what the actual rule is, and I didn't bring it with me, but I can get it to committee members. But it mentions designating the waters and what time of year the rice would be impacted, all those things that have not gone through the rulemaking process and we don't have information on yet. I don't know how the EPA could require Minnesota to enforce a 10 standard when they haven't completed the rulemaking process. So I have not submitted this bill to the EPA, but I'm well aware of the correspondence between Representative Dill, Senator Bach, and the EPA back in 2011.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I want to talk a little bit about public perception, because in a sense that is so much a part of what our process is about here. And so my confusion, because the 2011 laws clearly sent us on this trajectory of the study, and we do, in fact, for some reason it wasn't released, but we do in February 2014, we have the summary of findings and preliminary recommendations, a legislative briefing document, and key findings. Sulfate is not directly toxic to wild rice. Both the MPCA study and the research commissioned by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce support this conclusion. However, sulfate in the surface water can be converted by bacteria to sulfide in the rooting zone of wild rice. Sulfide is toxic to wild rice. The MPA study demonstrated that elevated sulfide concentrations were toxic to wild rice seedlings. They go on, and then their preliminary recommendations. The 10 standard is needed and reasonable to protect wild rice production from sulfate-driven sulfide toxicity. The standard should continue to apply to both the lakes and streams, but there are a number of, two and a half pages. And here is the concern I have. There's a whole middle. There's probably some group that I would probably be included in that group, would take a very, very cautious approach when we're dealing with water. We would take no chances because it's all we've got, and cleaning it up is going to cost a lot of money. And then there are some who believe somehow jobs are the overriding issue over everything. But then I think there's a whole middle ground who've sort of trusted that, well, they're saying they'll do the right thing. And so maybe this is going to be okay. But here's the dilemma. All of our debate here is about changing standards. And so what is the comfort that the public has? And my concern now about the work that the PCA has done, this study hasn't been released publicly. We have copies of it. What happens if somehow now those recommendations are changed to more smoothly allow these changing standards? How is the public to perceive that? And so I think we are at a very difficult moment when I hope science does drive and not politics or ideology or great desire to streamline jobs, that ultimately we are talking about the quality of our water in Minnesota, and you sometimes can't go back.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. Members, next I have Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I'd like to kind of circle back to what we were doing yesterday. We were talking about peer review, and the agency said that they, on their peer review, could you just refresh my memory on how you go about peer review?
Commissioner Flood. Director Lotthammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, typically when we're doing water quality standards, we're basing the science of that information on work that has gone through a scientific publication process. And a fundamental part of that process is independent peer review for a publication or for a journal to accept a paper for publication. In the case of the wild rice sulfate study, we knew that we were going to be doing our own analysis because we had commissioned the study and we were doing the analysis with the funding that the legislature had provided, and that we would be making recommendations likely before any of the results from the study would have gone through that scientific journal publication process. So given that, we actually undertook a peer review ourselves. We funded it. The agency funded it. We contracted with an independent company that does peer review for the federal government, for states, for the Office of Management and Budget on the federal level. They actually conducted the peer review process. So we provided input and feedback on the types of questions that we had that we would like feedback from the peer reviewers on. We provided information about the types of expertise that we thought would be necessary from the peer reviewers. There was a public nomination process where anyone who was interested in nominating someone to serve on the peer review could nominate that to the company that was hired. They handled all of the vetting for both scientific expertise and for a potential conflict of interest, made the final selections for the peer reviewers, and then we provided information through that company about our analysis and the study to date. The peer reviewers then reviewed that information, had preliminary comments, and then there was actually a public meeting that was held in August, a two-day meeting where there was the opportunity for the public to provide feedback and information to the peer reviewers, and then they had a public discussion about the questions that were posed and the scientific veracity and about the analysis, and then their suggestions about the analysis going forward as well. And then that culminated in a report that ERG, the company that we contracted with, compiled from the peer reviewers and then provided to the agency at the end of September of 2014, which we then put on our public website and made sure that the advisory committee and other interested parties had access to.
Follow up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's kind of a review of the literature is what I'm getting through that. How about, did anybody do any replication of the actual science that was involved in getting to the point that you did, where you submitted for peer review?
Director Lotthammer.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not aware of anyone that's replicating the exact science. I do know that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has also done some of the, or has contracted to do some laboratory studies looking at the effects of sulfate and I believe sulfide on wild rice. And that information, the sulfate information, has been provided to us. And any information that folks gather or additional studies that are done as we move forward in the rulemaking process, we would absolutely consider and look at as we're moving forward in that process.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to follow up a little bit more on the permit application process and the issuance and so forth, you've said that EPA has objections to what may be going on in terms of issuing a permit. If MPCA were to issue a permit, could the Citizens Board reject that with their authority, Ms. Lotthammer?
Commissioner Flood.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what usually happens in terms of permit issuance is if a permit is contentious or there's a concern that a permittee has or a member of the public and they request a matter go to the board, or if the through the issuance of the permit and development of a draft permit, if there's a request for a contested case hearing, and that when one is conducted, anything that is goes through that process is brought to the board for a final decision. So the board would have an opportunity to weigh in on whether or not a permit should be issued, a rule should be issued, that sort of thing, when it goes through that administrative process.
And Commissioner Flood, any single member of the Citizens Board can ask for any issue to come before the board, correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
And they have absolute permitting authority over the entire agency, correct?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what you mean by absolute permitting authority.
If they say no, it doesn't get granted.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's my understanding, yes,
Thank
of
you.
How the board works.
Follow up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just two real quick things. I'm concerned, you know, as somebody who represents rural Minnesota, you know, the cost to municipalities to meet this, if this is applied statewide, is going to be huge. Has the agency done any sort of cost analysis of what it's going to cost to bring the entire state of Minnesota in line with the 10-milligram standard?
Commissioner Flood?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have not yet at this time. A general cost evaluation would be conducted as a part of the preparation of our statement of need and reasonableness. And that's where there would be a discussion. In addition, once a rule is adopted and it's applied through the permitting effort, individual facilities, we take cost into account as individual permits are developed.
Last
and we have different mechanisms to accommodate some flexibilities.
Last follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just... you know, there's so many things that we could talk about. I know there's other people on your list. If we have time, I'll come back to some things. I'll yield my time to the rest of the members. You want to be done by 9 o'clock, I heard you say. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian, I've got a number of folks on the list. So, Representative Hackbarth, we've got your bill last today, and I looked at the testifiers list. It's like it's all people that are around here. So if we need to move yours tomorrow, Representative Hackbarth, would that work? Okay, thank you. So we're going to keep going, members. We're going to try and be wrapped up by 9:15. We still may be able to meet our entire agenda. Next, I have Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think most of my questions have been answered by other representatives, but I do have a couple comments. I've been sitting here for 2 days listening to this very serious issue, and I also feel that we need to protect our wild rice resources in northern Minnesota. I think that's very important. But I guess I've seen, and my impressions are here, that the MPCA has really shirked their responsibility. We've had this issue on the books since the 70s, and now it comes before us. You know, we failed to follow process. Rulemaking should have been done many, many years ago. We've enforced the law unequally, granted variances and things that before we've really done rulemaking. And then the science of this, we're basing this on a 1940s science. And if anybody should be looking at modern science, it should be the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. this body of science is out there, the peer review that you spoke about, that we subbed out. I hate to think how much that costs us, and nothing's been done. And I think really we do have to start this bill. Representative Moline's bill is a good faith effort to start over in a rulemaking process. And my God, it's the 21st century, and we're still dealing with stuff that was World War II type science. We have to do better than this, and the stakes are so high. I'm very concerned about the costs to our cities, to our industry, and to wild rice. So you have to do a better job. Thank you.
Any comment? Commissioner Flood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will remind the committee that we are moving forward with rulemaking. We're nearly completed with a draft package. I think, as I mentioned yesterday, that as early as the end of March, we'll have that package, which will include the list of a draft list of wild rice waters. It will include any potential revision to the standard and the criteria by which we list waters, as well as a permitting strategy. And in terms of, as Director Lauthammer mentioned, in terms of our process for revising a standard, we're required under the Clean Water Act to take a look at what our standards are every 3 years, and if there's scientifically reviewed literature out in the world that relates to anything where we have standards, we're required under that Clean Water Act to take a look at what that peer-reviewed literature says about the different types of uses that we're trying to protect, whether that's wild rice or drinking water or fish and wildlife, those types of things. So because wild rice is really a unique resource in the state of Minnesota, there has not been a lot of research that's been conducted throughout the decades on the impact of various chemical constituents or biological processes on the impacts of wild rice. So that just really wasn't available over the course of time. And to your point, Representative, I think that one of the things that we have been doing in doing the research for this rule revision is actually taking a look at the work that was done in the 1940s and trying to repeat that in the field and look at the different impacts of constituents on wild rice. So that will be included in our standards package.
Representative Hughlin.
Well, thank you. I certainly hope so, because if this, it seems that this 10 milligram standard is way outdated, and obviously we have to protect our resources, and that's what you're charged to do. But this seems like bureaucracy at its finest. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I have Representative Fisher. To this point, Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out again. You know, Representative Houseman was quoting from the, I guess it was a draft or some kind of a document just this year that confirmed the 10 standards. So I think it would be inaccurate to say that there's been no science since the 40s. Clearly science was involved in preparation of that document. So that, and again, that's a document from last year. So I thought that would be important to point out.
Representative Hornstein, you could look at those two documents and argue the standard should be 1600. It's clear and concise that the standard, the science says it should be 10. You could go jump on the other side of that argument and argue it's 1600, and we could all move on to Representative Anderson's bill in a quick hurry. So unfortunately, it's probably supposed to be somewhere between 10 and 1600, and that's what we're charged with today. Director Lauthammer, did you have a comment to that point?
Mr. Chair, members, I did just want to clarify the February report that's been referenced. That was a draft report that the agency was working on at the time. We did finalize that report in March 2014. Between the draft report and in February and the report in March, we really realized that we needed to do some more analysis of the data. So the final report does not indicate that 10 is supported. We didn't come to that conclusion. That was some of our earlier thinking as we were thinking through the information. But really, as we went further through the analysis, we recognized that we needed to look at the data more closely, look at some of those site-specific factors that I mentioned. That doesn't mean that we did still conclude or or at least have a preliminary conclusion that sulfate isn't directly toxic, but sulfide is an issue, and sulfide is toxic, so those findings stayed the same. But I do just want to clarify where we were at with that 10 milligrams per liter at the time. We recognized it was premature to settle on 10, that we needed to do some additional work, and that's what we've been doing.
Represent Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, just you know, and to that point, the report that Chair House or Representative Hausman was reading from, I remember the word "can" in there. It, you know, it doesn't sound like the science is definitively. It said it can cause this. It doesn't say it will. It's kind of like us here in the legislature. We allow an agency. We say may do something or we shall do something. So there's a difference between what was. And then also the chamber. They mentioned the chamber. Position and the University of Minnesota studies, those two, those are not harmonious either, I'll say. There are some differences there in the findings. So,
Representative Hornstein, any additional follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions on sulfate, sulfide, and I don't know if the Director or Commissioner will be able to answer these for me. One of the two probably will. First of all, in terms of the disease occur, and they happen in the environment, sulfate and then sulfide, do they naturally break down, or is this something that once it's formed, it stays around forever?
Director Lotthammer, give us a two-minute synopsis of what the difference is between those two things and what we should be worried about and what they are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So the difference between sulfate and sulfide, they're both forms of sulfur. Sulfate is present in oxygen-rich environments, so in flowing waters and surface waters where there's oxygen, you're primarily going to find sulfate. What happens when, and then sulfate can diffuse into the sediments. What happens there is the sediments typically have low or no oxygen in them, and that triggers different types of reactions. And ultimately, in the absence of oxygen, there are bacteria that can use sulfate as an energy source and convert that sulfate into sulfide in the process. Rather than using oxygen and converting it to carbon dioxide, they use sulfate and convert it to sulfide. There are things that can both enhance that reaction because it's bacteria that are doing it. The more bacteria you have, the more potential you have for that conversion. So things like organic matter can increase the rate of that conversion. But then there's also mitigating factors, and I mentioned these earlier, and that is one of the potential mitigating factors is if there's iron present in the sediment, then as that sulfide is being produced, iron can grab onto that sulfide and then pull it out of solution so that it's now in a solid phase or in a tied up phase, and it can't then affect a plant like wild rice. So that those were some of the more specific factors that enhance or inhibit this reaction of sulfate to sulfide and the effect of wild rice that we recognized back in February that we needed to look at a little more, and that's why we needed to further do some analysis on the data that we had.
Did you answer Representative Fisher's original question, or do you want to restate it?
I kind of want to restate that. Is in terms of the sulfide, I understand that the iron can break it down. Is there anything else that does, or will that sulfide continue to build up until something interacts with it?
Director Lotthammer.
Mr. Chair, I would need to bring in some of our scientists to talk about some of the other factors that can play a role. It looks like iron is one of the primary factors, and that often the iron is or can be replenished by groundwater coming in. So that can be more of a continual reaction as opposed to kind of a one-time reaction. Those are some of the things that we're continuing to investigate in the data set that we have.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm understanding correctly, depending how things interact, it could continue to build up, or if there's something else, it will start to latch on and precipitate out. Correct?
Director Lotthammer.
Mr. Chair, yes. And to your earlier question as well, and I apologize for not quite getting it, one of the things, if the oxygen conditions change, so if oxygen goes down into the sediment, then that sulfide can be reconverted back to sulfate and be either released into the overlying water or be available as sulfate back in the sediment. So there are processes that can break down sulfide besides just that grabbing onto the iron. Oxygen plays a big role in that.
Representative Fisher.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I'm kind of hitting along is I'm very concerned about water quality issues going forward. And having lived in an area of the state where things happen, people didn't think they were bad for the water, it got in the water, and now we've got groundwater. Part of the reason we have groundwater is not available is because they're using it to try to pull things back in. And I can understand the frustration that people may have because this process is slow, but at the same time, I can understand when we haven't been aware of the consequences, we have long-term consequences that can have impacts in other areas, not only on cost, but water quality. And we're trying to also protect another natural resource here. So I understand the frustration that people have with taking so long, but I also understand that this is very unique and that there seems to be ways that if it is out there, if we have problems with sulfides, there might be ways that people can address that issue also in the water. Would that be a correct statement in terms of the, Mr. Chair, to the testifiers? Would that be correct? If sulfide was too high, there'd be ways that people could address that also?
Director Lotthammer.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that there's definitely the potential for that. There isn't a lot of research that's been done looking at restoration techniques if there's high sulfide. You know, this relationship between sulfate, sulfide, and wild rice is still relatively new science, but I think there will be interest in that going forward.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask Representative Molina a question and, at least for the moment, get back on track on the actual bill. But before I do that, I wanted to say that I truly enjoyed what Representative Hausman had to say, because this is probably the very best thing that could happen in this state, to have this kind of public participation to get at least some understanding generally by the public about exactly what's going on here, about the idea about the long delay and its implementation, the difficulties of establishing what wild rice receiving waters actually are, what the standard may be now, what it may be in the future, if it is unchanged. And this is a huge dilemma for our state, and we have an important resource to protect. There are the issues of the north regarding taconite that are important to us, our community, no different than the Medtronic firm or General Mills would be if you lived in the metropolitan area. Jobs are important whether you live regardless, the material. So there's always that passion. But mixed in that passion, at least in the north and many other places, is the idea that we have to do everything we can to protect the heritage from where we came. And in the north, we did such a good job that they made a federal wilderness out of it for us. So all those hundreds of years before that federal wilderness was designated, the people, the indigenous people and the people who followed and those before them took excellent care of the land so that it could then be kept for that purpose, and it was followed with the designation of Minnesota's only national park right next to all of this iron ore formation. And I think that proves, regardless of where you live, that you take care of your own backyard. But then there's the strategic idea of what the North, what the state should be looking at, as well as jobs and what is right in this case for wild rice. The production of taconite on the Iron Range right now sits at about 40 million tons of pellets. And that varies from year to year and depending on the economy. But 40 million has been our recent number that we've been close to. That is one grain of sand on a beach on the ocean of worldwide capacity. But our country depends on it. We built bridges and tanks to win wars, and ships and cars and refrigerators and washing machines and everything that's steel, life without Fe, iron. That is what is also a part of this. And so the question is, with regard to the standard and the application of it, is if the standard is such that it prohibits continuing on with mining so that we can compete in a worldwide basis. There are companies today that are flooding the market with not only steel but taconite pellets to make it for the simple purpose of getting out the ones with the weak knees. It's not an unusual business practice, frankly, in big business. It's happening in oil, they say now, and some of us are benefiting on the short term. But this is a multifaceted problem that doesn't have one set solution that I think this committee has to keep its eye on as we go forward. But, Mr. Chairman, back to the bill. I have to ask and thank you for that indulgence. I have to ask the author, Representative Moline, does this bill or any other bill carried by an Iron Range delegation member, and everybody in this room knows who we are, ask to change the standard? Is there any bill to your knowledge in the legislature of 2014 that asked to change the standard?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, not that I'm aware of.
Representative Dill.
Thank you very much. There isn't. And the reason is because of all the things I just talked about. But there is a bill before us today that doesn't change the standard, as you just figured out or heard, but asks a simple, what seems to be simple, that before you get a heart transplant, you find out if your heart's any good. Before we apply this standard, we need to know where it needs to be applied to protect the wild rice. And the PCA has woefully failed at that. And they've had 40 years to do it, or more. And now suddenly, as the taconite industry began to perk up, this is not right at the moment, it's on a down because of this downturn in the prices, companies came in and wanted to expand. And another kind of flyer came in, and that was Polymet. But what I want everyone at this table to know, and everyone in the audience to know, that the precious metal mine that's proposed in the Northeast, which also provides strategic metals that we do not produce anywhere in the United States, that we will then become independent of others for that particular metal, they have always said in every draft permit, environmental impact statement, supplemental impact statements, and those that followed, that they would meet the 10 standard without any difficulty. But the difference is the size of the pipe. The pipe at these mines, the precious metal mines, are tiny compared to what it takes to make taconite. And the taconite industry's got the environmental community and others, not just them, and I won't just pick on them because I'm not picking on anybody here today. But those folks have pulled in taconite mining, in my view, because of the new permits that have been brought forward regarding a new permit request, or I should say environmental documents for it, for that. This bill asks to do the right thing. And if the EPA doesn't like the right thing, then we've got to figure out how to work. So if they're going to trump us and knock us down and do all of the things that I said, stop the job, stop the strategic metals, and those types of things that are important to us, we just got to work with them. And I do not believe the PCA is making that effort a strong enough case for us, and it's evident in all the things that have been discussed here in this meeting, and the delays, and the no action, and the no study, and the no information, and the excuses that have been going on since I've been here in the legislature. And then I have just a very short question about Fond du Lac. Fond du Lac is one of the tips of the sword. Fond du Lac Tribal Council and Band is one of the tips of the sword of advancing this idea that this standard needs to be applied. So I have to ask a couple of questions of the PCA, and I hope that you can answer them. With regard to Fond du Lac, they have a major facility on Interstate 35. Most people know what it is. And I understand that they are hooked to the Western Lake Sanitary District sewer for their discharge. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Flood, if you don't know, you can get back to us. Commissioner Flood.
I believe that's the case, but I'd have to confirm that and get back to you.
We'll assume it is and get back to us if it's different. Representative Dill.
Well, then the next question is why would they go all that distance for that if they weren't trying to avoid the 10 standard? Because Western Lake Sanitary District doesn't have a 10 standard in their permit. If they built their own wastewater treatment, you're telling us, and they ask for a permit now, you'd have to give them a 10 standard. And so by going to Duluth, they don't have to build their own plant, and they don't have to meet any standard because Western Lake Sanitary District, which does discharge into known wild rice waters, doesn't have the 10 standards. So that's a perplexing question to me. And I don't know the answer to it. I guess I'm searching for the answer. If you want to get back to us, that would be, unless you can answer it now.
Mr.
Commissioner Flood.
Representative Dill, I think I would prefer to get back to you, make sure we have our facts correct, but my understanding where the location of the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District discharge is downstream of wild rice water, so there would not be a standard applicable to their discharge at this point. But so I'd prefer to get back to you with more information unless you have something that you want to.
Thank you, Commissioner, and Representative Dill. I'll fire off a letter to the Fond du Lac tribe to get their opinion on that. Representative Dill.
So I'm to assume then that because they're below, that not anywhere on Lake Superior is there wild rice below the aerial lift bridge on Lake Superior.
Commissioner Flood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would again prefer to double check our information and provide you with a response.
If you could get back to us on that. Representative Dill.
Last question about Fond du Lac. I recall, and I don't remember, so I'm just asking a question so that you can find out the information, that they have some exemption for mercury discharge as well.
Commissioner Flood.
Again, Mr. Chair, I would prefer to get back to you with the information.
Please do. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dill. To this point, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just wanted to point out that the Commissioner Flood said that they were discharging below where the wild rice beds are, but we heard earlier that we don't know where the wild rice beds are necessarily.
Thank you. I have two questions, and then we're going to move on. Representative Molina will give a wrap-up, and then we'll move through our bills. I have Representative Purcell, then Representative Clark. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Interesting, and thank you for bringing up Fond du Lac Band, Representative Dill, and I my question goes to that, and if we do indeed, and the talk has been about what the bill does and what the bill does not do, and I think if the bill did not suspend the standard, we probably would have wrapped this up a long time ago. But the bill suspends the current standard, and the heart transplant analogy, Representative Dill, you wouldn't jerk the heart out of the patient before you knew you had a new one to put in there, right? So so that doesn't fit very good. The Fond du Lac Band and two other tribes in Minnesota, as I understand, have their own water quality standards. If we as a state legislature suspend this standard, does that suspend their standard, or do their standards still apply? So, and my knowledge of those tribes and the waters that they exert jurisdiction over is the majority of the wild rice in Minnesota. So, you know, how big a wheel are we spinning here is my question with what we're doing, because I don't think this impacts what the tribes do. What we do does not impact their jurisdiction over the right they have to protect their water quality and their wild rice.
Representative Purcell, I think you did the thing that they often teach legislators to not do, and you didn't do it. You knew the answer to your own question, and I believe you gave it at the end, so I don't know that either one of you need to answer. Thank you. Thank you for that perspective, Representative Purcell. We always appreciate it. Last question, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask a question related to one of the points that was made yesterday about violation of treaty rights, and I wanted to ask the author what her approach is to that point that was made yesterday. And I would just say that my understanding is that, you know, almost 200 years ago we had treaty rights that protected wild rice. It's the only grain that is protected in federal treaty rights. And so no matter what the EPA or the state does on this, I guess I'm interested in how you would respond to that concern, because then we have another whole level of action to talk about. So I'm just curious about your response, and then maybe if the agency has anything to say about their approach to that issue too.
Representative Moline, do you want to go first, or do you want the agency? Agency, do you have any comment on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, certainly it, the action that's taken here does not suspend any water quality standards that may have been adopted by tribal governments. And certainly one of the processes that, although there have been members of tribal bands that have participated in the Wild Rice Advisory Committee, we have not done a formal consultation with them. The advisory committee is more of a stakeholder involvement process where we get their advice as we proceed through the rulemaking and rule development and the research. But we have not yet had a government-to-government conversation between the Pollution Control Agency in the development of the rule and the bands as through a formal consultation process.
Representative Lane.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, and I am not going to pretend to be well-versed enough in our treaties to be able to thoroughly answer your question. The sulfate standard did not come into place under treaty authority. It came into place under a person who used to work for what is now the DNR, making observational studies in the field, and then the PCA adopting that standard. So it wasn't adopted under a treaty. You know, that being said, you know, I don't know the treaties well enough to know, you know, how this fits in with that. I will say, though, in regards to the tribal communications and in Representative Purcell's initial comments, you know, I understood the complaints yesterday to be that they hadn't been involved in the process. I didn't know that it was specifically towards the suspension of the rule. So if I made comments that made you think that we were in communications regarding that specific suspension, that was not my intent. What I said yesterday was the 2011 law requires the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency establish criteria for waters after consultation with Minnesota Indian tribes. Additionally, the tribes are required to serve on the advisory group. Under my bill, that participation by the tribes is required under law for the rulemaking of the designation and criteria for wild rice waters, and it has always been in my intent that they are required to participate.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I would point out maybe to the author that the treaty rights go way beyond any particular compound contaminating the wild rice beds. So I'm not just trying to limit it to that. I just want us to pay respect to those treaty rights, because as far as I know, I think our state is on record at breaking every single treaty right we've ever, every single treaty with our native people that has been passed. You can look over at the state capitol in the governor's retiring room and see an example of it right on the wall, the treaty that's portrayed there. We broke, you know, short, not too long afterwards. But anyway, I just was hoping that we could have a higher standard, and I would be glad to talk more about this with the author. I just think we should keep in mind that there is a higher law here, and it's federal to federal, and we are underneath that. Thank you.
And Representative Clark, to that point of a higher standard, I remind members that the standard for wild rice is 10. The standard for drinking water is 50, if I'm not mistaken.
So 250, Mr. Chair.
250, excuse me. It's 1/25th of the standard. Closing comments, Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Just a few brief closing comments. You know, first of all, I think for, you know, as a matter of transparency, I think that I and committee members need more information on why the standard wasn't enforced for 47 years. I spoke to the MPCA right prior to this hearing this morning, and what I was told was basically they don't know for sure, they weren't around then, there was lots of laws on the books, and quote, they had bigger fish to fry when it came to mercury standards and others. Representative Torkelson then asked the question, and the response was, well, we didn't have enough data to enforce it. So, you know, we're hearing different reasons for why the standard wasn't enforced for 47 years, and I would like to know why exactly this became a priority around 2010 to enforce this standard. Additionally, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for the time you've taken on this bill and the time that the work that you've done in the past on this issue. You know that it's obviously very important to us on the Iron Range, but additionally, as been discussed, this is a statewide issue. Just yesterday, the PCA got me a list of facilities around the state that are now required to monitor sulfates. What I've been told in the past is the reason the taconite industries are the only ones subjected to the standard at this time is because they happen to be monitoring sulfates for years, and the PCA requires 1 year of monitoring before imposing the standard. There is now a lengthy list of facilities around the state that the PCA is requiring to monitor sulfates. Just to name a few of those, Austin Wastewater Treatment Plant, Blue Earth, wastewater treatment plant. Dairy Farmers of America in Winthrop, Fairmont Foods, Faribault Wastewater Treatment Plant, Fergus Falls, Heartland Corn Products, Madison, Minnesota Wastewater Treatment Plant, Milk Specialties Company, Pine River Area Sanitary District, Sleepy Eye, Starbucks, Thief River Falls, Worthington Industrial, just to name a few that shows you that the statewide impact of facilities that are now required to monitor sulfates and will likely fall under the standard as soon as we know where those waters are, those wild rice waters. Additionally, we do have some information already at facilities that are monitoring sulfates. Buffalo Lake Advanced Biofuels is discharging 1,000 milligrams per liter of sulfates. Corn Plus in Winnebago, Minnesota is discharging 250 milligrams per liter of sulfates. Granite Falls Energy, 1,403 milligrams of sulfates. High Water Ethanol, 250. Madison, Minnesota Wastewater Treatment Plant, 1,000. Milk Specialties, over 2,000. Keewatin Taconite is at 24. And I say that because our mining industries are substantially lower than a lot of agriculture and wastewater treatment plants who are now going to be required to meet that standard as well. And on the federal preemption, Mr. Chair, just to wrap up on this EPA issue, I think it is beyond reasonable to require that the rulemaking process is completed before the standard is imposed. I think the Clean Water Act anticipates that rulemaking will be completed before a water quality standard is imposed. After all, it is difficult to impose a water quality standard when the waters have not been identified. Therefore, we are not changing the standard. We are asking that the standard not be imposed until the science is complete and the rulemaking is complete. And Mr. Chair, I do appreciate the time that you and members have taken on this issue and for hearing our concerns today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, and thank you, Representative Moline. And truthfully, I didn't realize you were going to make that point that you made in the wrap-up, but it's been my point all along that I would argue the reality that the taconite mines will find a way to deal with this issue. My concern is the wastewater treatment plants throughout the state of Minnesota, and the map we were given yesterday I think clearly shows this is an entire state issue currently, and the biggest concern should be wastewater treatment plants in southern Minnesota that don't understand, and the people living down there have not seen wild rice in their area for decades, maybe centuries in some case, and they're totally befuddled with what's going on. So thank you for making the point. Thank you for being here, and thank everyone. If you're here for this bill and you want to leave now, we'll give just a minute. Representative Anderson, so if there's a little noise. Representative Anderson, I want you to come down, if you would, right away. Members, I'm going to move House File 483 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Anderson, I'm thinking that you can do your bill in just 5 minutes at the most, so that would work out. Why don't you give Representative Anderson just a few seconds for members to clear out that we're here just for that previous bill, as I think the noise on the tape will be beyond making it reasonable for you to react. Why don't you have just a little sec. Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I just want to let you know I need to be excused. I've got a constituent issue I've got to deal with, so
on to get that. All right. Representative Anderson, I've moved House File 483 for possible inclusion. Present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members. The reason behind this bill 483 comes from some new emission standards from the EPA, which we've heard about this morning. And these pertain to wood-burning stoves, heaters, fireplaces, things like that. As you may know, this new set of rules is called NSPS, or New Source Performance Standards. And it's a 5-year phase-in period, and we actually are in that period right now because on February 3rd, the EPA administrator submitted these regulations to the Federal Register. So we are now in step one of these new regulations of the NSPS, and it calls for a limit of 0.32 pounds per, I believe, million BTUs of heat produced by these wood-burning appliances. Now this standard seems to be attainable, as there are 10 states already that have adopted this standard, but it's phase two coming up that we are very concerned about. And has industry folks concerned that when that becomes effective, but that won't be for 5 years in the year 2020. The limits drop down from, I mentioned, 0.32 down to 0.15, and it's going to be very difficult and expensive to meet this new standard, according to the folks I've talked to that work in the industry. And at phase one, going from phase one to phase two, we already have achieved 90% of the emission reductions in phase one. So the phase two limits would bring up the topic of a cost-benefit relationship, and is there a benefit going to those phase two. What my bill simply does is prevent the state from enforcing these new federal regulations. And a bit of background, since back in 1988, the EPA has had these emission standards, and states have been delegated to enforce these clean air standard rules. And if this bill were to pass, I'm not sure what would happen. If the EPA would step in and do this enforcing themselves, this bill that I have is patterned after a Missouri bill, and they've actually passed it down in that state that they have told their DNR that they can't enforce these new standards unless the legislature gives specific approval to enforce these new standards. So, Mr. Chair, that's basically what this bill does, and it's caused some discussion, which is good. And I would be open for questions, or if anybody would care to testify, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson, what I would appreciate, is there anyone in the audience to speak for or against the bill? I guess the department wants to speak. I'm going to let the department speak, and I want to let members know, if this bill would happen to come back, that's when we'll take questions of Representative Anderson in regards to the phase two concerns of 2020. We could spend a lot of time having that discussion now, and you can probably read my thoughts on if the bill comes back, we'll have that discussion then rather than have the discussion now. Commissioner Thart.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is David Thornton, Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency. I'll be extremely brief. We prefer that you not take action on this bill. Because these are federal standards, there's nothing that we can do in the state to prevent or delay them from taking effect. They are standards that apply to the manufacturers, and they apply to the conditions of the devices that they produce. It's very much like how EPA regulates automobiles. They set the standards, and the manufacturers have to produce the product that meets the standards. Our concern is with this bill is that people may mistakenly interpret it to mean that it prevents the federal standards from applying in Minnesota, and I think that would put folks in a position that would be unfortunate. We think it would impact our ability to help people comply with the standards, and it reduces our flexibility to respond appropriately to future air quality problems.
Assistant Commissioner, thank you for your testimony. Members, this bill's laid over. Next, we'll hear from Representative Norness. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark. Sorry, Representative Anderson. Representative Clark might have a question.
I have a question for you. It's just for you. Is this laid over for possible inclusion, or is it just laid over? I didn't hear the possible inclusion. I was wondering what you were
It's intended. Laid over for possible inclusion. Possibility can anywhere from 0 to 100%.
Because I did have a question, but I guess if you want that to come later when we're debating the big bill, or I
would save all the questions about this bill to be when the bill comes back. So in other words, we probably don't need to discuss it right now because okay. You can probably figure that out.
I will do that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You've been here longer than I, Representative Clark. You got between the lines, I think, real well. Thank you, Representative Norness.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Representative Norness. I think Representative Hancock would probably like to move your bill, House File 79, for possible inclusion. Representative Hancock, this deals, I'm sorry, would you like to move this bill? This one's the one about the septic systems for campgrounds.
Sure, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 79. And where am I moving
it? It's for possible inclusion. This comes higher on the percentage possibilities, Representative Clark, so if you have questions, we're going to take them. Representative Norness,
sure.
We're trying to get back on schedule.
Yeah. Well, we'll be as brief as we can, but it's an important issue, so we'd
absolutely.
Like to House File 79 is an important issue for anyone that has campgrounds in their districts. And to actually get right to the testimony that's important this morning, I'd like to have Dan McElroy begin, Mr. Chair.
Former Representative McElroy, welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. And although we're principally concerned with campgrounds today, we're working with the PCA, which we appreciate. It likely needs to apply to resorts as well. In 2011, there was a change made to PCA rules regarding when a state-level subsurface discharge permit is required for facilities like resorts and campgrounds. Prior to 2011, the rule said that the PCA would consider proven flow, estimated flow, or a table that was in rule, table one now. In 2011, it changed to add the phrase, whichever is higher. And that has caused a significant problem for the operators of campgrounds. If there is a presumption in the table generally that there's 10,000 gallons of peak flow at the high use period for the season, it triggers a much more expensive and complex permit. If that is not triggered, then counties regulate septic systems as they have for a very long time. And I want to make clear our members value the environment. It's important to the land they own, to the legacy they leave for their children, to the enjoyment of waters by their guests. There is a limit, however, to what can be invested in compliance, and the subsurface systems, when you read the permit rules, appear to have been written for large industrial uses or for residential subdivisions and not for a single use like a campground or a resort. Now, as you will hear in a minute, we're very close to an agreement with the PCA on language we think will solve the problem. We'll go to a measured flow or estimated flow rather than the table. But I want you to hear from a couple of our members as to how serious this problem is and the financial implications if they have to go to this more sophisticated permit. The application for the permit is more than $9,000. It requires monitoring wells. It requires the services of a professional engineer rather than a septic designer or an advanced septic designer, and requires expensive annual reviews of system performance that are not appropriate for a simple campground or resort system. They may be appropriate for an industrial use or a subdivision. With that, Mr. Chair, our first testifier is Joe Alvord from Morningstar Campground near Richmond in Stearns County.
Thank you, Mr. McElroy. We'll hear the testimony. I think there might be a couple different folks from the resorts. We'll hear those and then members after we hear from those. Or if you have questions for the testifiers, just speak up. If you could identify yourself for the record and maybe the name of your resort and maybe what county it's in so we kind of get a perspective where you're coming from literally.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Joe Alvord. My wife and I own a campground in Richmond, Minnesota. It's Morningstar Resort and Campground, and we've been in the business about 20 years.
What county are you in?
Stearns County.
Thank you.
I guess I can go right to the handout that I did, huh?
Sure.
Okay, my wife and I recently had an interested party, which recently, by that I mean about a year or so ago, they offered to buy our campground. Well, the price we were asking was what we thought we should get, and actually they were going to pay it without haggling. Anyway, prior to the finalizing of our agreement, they had checked with the MPCA, and based solely on the fact that we had over 100 campsites, we were informed we were out of compliance due to regulations that we were totally unaware of. Due to this, our sale negotiations were immediately terminated by our buyer. We contacted Holly Christensen with the MPCA. She sent the following correspondence, and her correspondence was, "Good afternoon. I shared this data with our engineer that is assigned to this county, and he has determined that with 142 sites estimated at 100 gallons per day, the Morningstar Campground definitely needs a state disposal system permit with the MPCA. Following is a link to the MPCA's wastewater permit webpage. This should get you help with you started with the permitting process." And it goes through all the applicable things there and who we would work with and so forth. So at that point, we asked around the industry and some professionals in the business, and it was determined that to become compliant, it would be between $350,000 and $450,000. and then plus a permitting fee of $9,300 just to get started in this process. That would be just extremely an extreme financial hardship for us. Several campgrounds actually closed due to that. They couldn't see going through that process. And since 1995, we worked with Stearns County through several septic system installations and updates. The latest was in 2011. We have monitored both water and septic use for periods prior to each design and installation of these systems. And the state of Minnesota was notified and did their inspections on sewer and water systems, and nothing was ever mentioned about new regulations, which were apparently, I guess, already in effect. In 2014, we monitor our septic lift stations, that's this past summer, which serve 105 RV campsites and a bathhouse with four toilets, four showers, and a clothes washing machine. The data from our lift stations, and I want to say this is an estimate which the installer did for me on the amount pumped on each cycle. It's on our lift stations, we have what's called an event counter. So every time the lift station pumps out the effluent, it trips once. Okay, so this is what my data is based on, and he estimated the number of gallons by measuring the tank and the gallonage that would go in there. Anyway, the data from our lift stations over 152 days, which is May 1st through October 1st, indicates a discharge into the septic system of 238,950 gallons. If you divide that out by 105 campsites that it serves and the number of days of 152, it comes out to 14.98 gallons per camper per day. Now, that doesn't include peak usage, so I mean like your 4th of July week during that period would be higher, I'm sure. But I don't think it would be, and I've actually got previous data on that from this, from our system of measuring. And how they came up with 100 gallons per campsite per day, 365 days a year, for campers, I'm just totally amazed by that.
Mr. Alvord, I would say welcome to state government. I'm not surprised that you have 15 gallons and the MPCA has 100. That's why we're here today, and that's why they've got to get their act together to get it on board with you. Can you just wrap up where you're coming from? I think you just hit it. The one thing I wouldn't mind asking you is, I did a real quick analysis. It looks like the maximum you have is less than 16,000 camp days per year when I take the number of campsites times your days. And that would assume 100% occupancy. Can you give me the range? I don't really want to know your daily rate, but what would somebody charge if they had a RV park like yours per day, just for instance? What might be a range of it?
Per camper?
Per site.
Per site would probably be in the $40 to $60 range.
So if I took 50, that would mean that the potential absolute maximum would be $750,000 per year. I don't want to know your individual numbers. So a business that grosses probably in the neighborhood of what they want to fix your septic system. So 100% of your gross for a year would be to improve your septic system.
That's correct.
That's an interesting point. Any questions for Mr. Alvord? Senator, were you going to testify next?
I would like to.
You're a campground owner, right?
Yeah,
go ahead. Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
All right. I'm Al DeCripe. I own, my wife and I own Cicada Trail Resort in Le County.
Welcome, Senator. If you could give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My wife and I have owned and operated Cicada Trail Resort since 1995. We have grown our business from 56 permanent campsites to 116 over the years and have built a complete septic system up to complete code with Le Sieur County. We've upgraded our electrical services and drilled a second well. This past year, we also built a community center that doubles as a storm shelter. We're not afraid to invest wisely in our business, and we want to protect the environment. The estimated impact of a campground like ours is around $10,000 per year per campsite, or over $1 million of local economic impact for a campground our size. This helps the local bars, restaurants, gas stations, camper and boat sales. Local businesses really appreciate our campground bringing folks to the area. I believe our legacy is introducing children to the outdoors and enabling them to make life memories in camping, in playing and fishing on the lake, and bicycling the Sakata State Trail. I received a notice of violation issued by the MPCA in 2014 due solely to the size of our campground and their estimated flow calculations, which indicated we produce over 10,000 gallons per day of sewage. By the way, we were told we needed to have a system inspected, and we are actually in complete compliance. There's nothing that would have to be changed in our system to make it more environmentally friendly. I responded with data, with actual data from our lift stations and their readings and calculations, which indicate an average flow over a given 10-day period of time, which included the 4th of July and the weekend before and the weekend after. That should have been the busiest 10-day period we had, and we averaged 4,500 gallons a day over that same period of time. This reading was taken from from June 28th to July 8th, 2013, to which the MPCA indicated that they do not allow these calculations to be recognized, but the estimated flows that they supplied based upon the number of units must be used.
Senator, I got to stop you there.
Yes.
So you actually have data that proves how many gallons are going through it, and MPCA said you can't use the proof, you need to use their estimates?
That's correct.
Okay. I don't know if you have any more to add or if you want to just end on that point.
I'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sir, do you want to testify next?
Okay. My name is Jim Rose, and I'm from Riverside Resort. My wife and I bought the resort in 1979. I'd just like to make a general comment, and then I'll speak of a specific one. But the government regulations from 1979 to now have been unbelievable. Friends of mine that have left the business, that's usually the number one reason. We had over 4,000 resorts in the 1960s. We're down to 860 licensed resorts now. As far as the specific issue, in 2010, we were going to buy a neighboring cabin. Our resort right now has 19 cabins and 51 licensed RV sites. And we had an engineer come in, and that one we knew was uncompliant. So we wanted to add it to our septic system. And he came back to me and said, that kicks you over that 10,000-gallon limit. And he said, and he explained to me how you either use your actual flow or the table. And he said, there's no sense using your actual flow because the table the state uses is so high. So he said, we have to go with that. So he called MPCA, and they told him if there's any way you can get under that 10,000 gallons, just the expense and so on, was worth not doing it. But we had already purchased the cabin. So the easiest way out of that was we had 54 licensed campsites, so we gave up some campsites to get us below the 10,000 gallons. But since that time, I put on digital meters on our softeners, and I can show you at peak time, which was the 4th of July, we used 2,000 gallons of water a day, and even give or take 10%, but we're not even close to that 10,000. And yet our septic system right now is designed for 10,000 gallons. And we're a seasonal business. We run from May to October. And during a week when there's nobody in the campsite or very few people, there's no way that we're even close to that. But anyways, we have that design system for 10,000 gallons now. And if we try to expand, now we'd have to go into that more expensive system.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I appreciate that. To Representative Nornes and to Mr. McElroy, it's our intention to include this bill for possible inclusion, short of MPCA not coming back with something reasonable. And that would include, absolutely at a minimum, if campgrounds know how much water is going through their system and have data records that prove it, why are we not using that data to interpolate to other campgrounds? I would assume that ones that have data recorders are processing a similar amount of waste from the people attending those as the ones without the data recorders, unless somebody really wants to make a smart aleck remark that probably wouldn't be right to get on the tape. So I think you've made your point to this. I don't know if MPCA may be all skedaddled out the door with the last bill, but would you like them to? There is a question. I see a hand coming up. Mr. McElroy first, and then Representative Hausman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take the question. There are people here from MPCA, and it's a different division that worked with the previous issue. and they've been very cooperative in working with us on this issue. They've been more challenging because of the rule change in 2011. And I see Assistant Commissioner Kudelka is ready to come down briefly, but I'd be happy to take the question.
Why don't we take, there's a couple of questions. We'll take those questions. I was being sarcastic. I do want the department to weigh in because I do want, I know you're close to having a deal worked out, but you might be negotiating too much away. And I find that hard to believe. Former Representative McElroy, you chaired a really important committee when I first came, so I know how good of a negotiator you are, so I'm assuming you're doing a good job here, too. Representative Hausman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That was just, I was grateful to Mr. McElroy because his rhetoric was a bit more respectful, but I mean, these are human beings sitting here in the room, and we charge them with protecting our air and water, and the ridicule that they're subjected to is quite incredible. I hope they are always given the opportunity to answer.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's what I was going to do. Is I saw MPCA was here. I was going to give them a chance to come down and defend their position and ask for that.
I intended to bring them down, and I certainly respect President Hausman. Somebody I have, sometimes I have a little bit too much levity. Is that the right word?
Levity.
Just lightening things up here a little bit once in a while because it gets a little bewildering when somebody says, I've got the facts to say this much, but we don't care about the facts. We want to go by this. So that's frustrating at times. And I certainly respect Representative Hausman where you're coming from. I've always been upfront with the agencies and know how hard they work. And to be grilled like they were this morning is tough for them to be here. I realize that. Representative Fabian, is your question for Commissioner Kudelka?
Well, it was actually for Mr. Albert. You let him go away from the table.
No, we'll bring him back.
Okay.
Stay by, Commissioner. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Albert, for being here and bringing this concern before us. I have a lot of empathy for you, and I just have a few questions. Your septic system, how near is that to a lake or something like that?
My particular system that... I'm sorry.
You're okay.
Yeah, it's all right. Just we're near the end of the day.
Mr. Chairman, members, my septic system that I'm referring to is probably 1,300 feet from the lake.
Representative Fabian, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Alberts, I'm just curious to know if you have any children or grandchildren or if you have friends and neighbors that have children and grandchildren and use the waters in the area.
Absolutely.
Mr. Alford.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You.
Well, you
this
probably know
follow-up, Representative?
You probably know where I'm going, Mr. Chair. It's really discouraging to me when we read stuff and hear stuff. You know, I've got this off the internet from NPR News, stated by one of the environmental groups here. There's a general push from the rural areas saying we don't want to protect our waters the way the science says we should. To me, that's extremely offensive. I just don't quite understand where this stuff is coming from. It's in your best interest to have clean water in your area. I mean, and in the science, okay, where the science says we should, we have science in this case that probably says where we should be, and the science isn't being used. And I just find it incredibly disappointing that MPCA continues to do this type of stuff to hardworking Minnesotans who want to provide a service and a product for their customers. And I guess I would ask somewhat rhetorically that if these resorts are closed down, does that increase traffic into our state parks, Mr. Chair? Thank you.
Commissioner Kudelka, welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself. Thank you, Mr. Alford. Appreciate it. Commissioner Kudelka and members, we will not be hearing, as you probably ascertained, Representative Hackbarth's House File 572, and that will not be on tomorrow's agenda. It'll be rescheduled at a later date. Ms. Lewis, I'm sorry. We should have told you a while ago. I didn't see you sitting there. I apologize to you and the DNR. Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kudelka, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I just wanted to echo the comment made by Mr. McElroy that we are close to an agreement here. We do have an agreement on changing how it's done right now. The PERT rule is estimated flow or measured flow and the higher of two to make sure that each campground was treated the same across the state. And that was the rationale for Having had further discussions with the Campground Association and individual campgrounds, we are willing to make that change. What we're still working on is, you've heard a number of different ways to measure here, from water softeners to potentially water appropriations to others. We want to have an agreement with the two parties here to make sure we all have the same understanding of what is the numbers and measurement tool that's used, because some of them are more proxies from what's actually going into the septic system. And I think that's what's right now the only difference between us, is making sure we have that agreement between the two parties.
And Commissioner Kadalka, I appreciate that. And as you know, we visited about this issue late last night in person. So I think you, I'm assuming the agency, and I want to apologize if you were offended by my comments. I knew you were working on it. I know you're close. To represent Fabian's point, it is frustrating at times when it seems like logic's not being followed. I have Representative Hausman's question. Did you have a follow-up?
No.
No. Representative Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Kadalka, you speak of this possible agreement and things. Is there going to be an additional cost to our taxpayers, campgrounds and the resort industry with this agreement? Is there going to be additional costs, additional permitting?
Mr. McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Uglum, the agreement we're working on is that we will come to an agreement that the amount of flow into a septic system can't logically exceed the amount of water pumped, or the technical term, the amount of water appropriated, and so that a relatively simple water meter added to a well installation is what will be required. They cost a few hundred dollars per well. My members are willing to do that, both so they'll know that we're under the 10,000, protect the environment. It is not a bad thing to know. So there is some cost to the permittees, but it is manageable, and it is very small compared to the cost of having to do the more sophisticated permit.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to know.
And Mr. McElroy, if you'll work with Mr. Elward on that issue as you move forward, that would be great. Thank
we
you.
We believe that the water softener may be a good proxy. The lift stations are hard data, and so the campgrounds that have them, but not all campgrounds, topography requires them to have lift stations.
Okay. We'll continue to work with the testifiers as we go forward. Representative Nornes, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, I just appreciate you working us in this morning. It's been a busy day for your committee, and we appreciate moving forward that hopefully we'll succeed.
Well, thank you for being before us. Tomorrow, members, we have a couple of Representative Fabian's bills. We're adjourned.